Welcome to the show. I'm James.
I'm David.
I'm Riley.
And today we are discussing Heat. We'll laugh, we'll argue, you might get a little too into it, but at the end of the day, they're just movies.
Spoiler alert.
Straight up.
Least, man.
Hey, guess what? We're the show that got a mail-in five-star review.
Oh, wow.
That's not how this works.
That's how they.
No,
that's how much they
Chris
care.
Cotter.
Do it more.
It's not from Matthew Noonan?
Nope, Chris wrote, I know you guys love reviews, so 5 stars, 10 out of 10, bang up job. And then they went on to tell me lots of other stuff.
You want to read the whole thing?
I can't share it all.
There's
with
something
you.
About Guardians of the Galaxy?
That's what episode Chris is on.
Oh. Chris?
That's
oh, that he's working his way through the backlog. Oh, I see.
I don't know what this person identifies.
Like we had them on the podcast. That's what I thought you meant.
Nope.
Let's move on. Hey, thanks for the review.
Would you think that? Anyways, next week, we're going to do a very special episode. It's a type of mailbag episode that we've never done before called the therapy episode.
I'm so excited.
You guys and gals write us in with your problems, relationship, familial, otherwise, and we are going to solve your problems for you.
You guys kept calling it the therapy episode in our private conversations, and I thought you meant that like we were having therapy for us.
No, we're the therapist.
So we are providing life advice.
Yeah.
And we will be charging accordingly.
It's going to be hilarious.
Because we have everything figured out.
And useful.
That's what you have to do before you become a therapist.
Yes.
Solve all your problems.
The perspective of us. next week, though, we're going to do a movie. And it's going to be Kung Pao, Enter the Fist.
No!
Chosen One!
I haven't watched this since a sleepover in grade 7 or something.
I watched this movie a billion times.
We loved it, though.
I don't know how that episode is going to go. It just quotes.
I'm scared.
But today is Heat all day. So, David, give us your rating out of 10 for Heat.
Be lulled to sleep by Heat's snail-paced character drama, then woken up by loud gunshots. Bang, bang, bang. Heat's heist might be tense and thrilling, but gosh darn, that movie needs to lose about 50 minutes.
Woo!
7.4 to 10.
That sounded like a Riley slogan, I'd say.
The bang, bang, bang.
Bang, 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 shooty, shooty, boys.
Give us the real
back
one.
Back and forth. This is my slogan. Man, this movie brings the heat. Heat in this case, meaning a simultaneous blend of plotting, dragged out plot development, strangely complicated social arrangements, and sudden excessive action sequences. If this was an hour and a half shorter, it could be an 8. As it is, it's a 5.5.
Holy.
Oh, nice.
I there were times where I'm like, okay, yeah. So it was like I could be here or I couldn't. I felt like really, really neutral about it. I'm on the plus side of the 5 because I recognize that, you know, there's some good things about it, but it was just annoying me.
Wow. That's an injustice.
I was annoyed.
A technical achievement with compelling action set pieces, great acting. And, oh, damn it, I said compelling twice. Compelling characters in a high-stakes situation that just goes on and on. Heat is somewhere between an 8 and an 11. I'm giving it a 9.
Sure.
Wow.
It's a freaking great movie every respect. And I wasn't even enhanced this time, you guys.
Nice.
Dang.
I do watch movies sober sometimes.
I think you are. I think you got some nostalgia goggles on, to be frank.
No, I've only seen this movie once.
When you were? Small.
Early college.
Yeah.
Yeah, like
formative time.
19 or something.
You're still developing your brain.
I think this is the kind of movie that if you knew it was 3 hours going in or you went to a movie theater, it would have been like a friggin' 9 or a 10 out of 10. It's awesome,
yeah.
But it really suffers from being a movie in 2022 where like I just want to move on from this content and get to the next thing.
Well, there's lots of long ass movies these days, like Eternals and crap. Like there's tons of, it seems like every movie is over 2 hours now, whereas that used to be a long movie. This movie though should be 225.
There's no reason. Yeah, it would there's really no reason for
when
this
I saw
movie
it
to
was 250.
Long.
I mean, 10 minutes of that's credit. So let's say it's 1040 or 240. I thought that I don't remember it being a freaking 3 hour movie.
I have to acknowledge that if I knew about the movie beforehand, if I was like a little hyped to watch it, or if I had watched trailers or like spent some time thinking about it beforehand, I maybe wouldn't have been so like disappointed, or I was annoyed that I had to watch
this
movie.
You also were watching it between the hours of midnight and 2 a.m.
I was watching it late at night.
So, come on.
You know,
come on.
In a different situation, maybe it would be like a 6.5.
Come on! Yeah! We were doing Limp Bizkit earlier.
I cannot see the 9 in this movie at all, but you can try to convince me.
right after
this message
from
our
sponsor, Vessi Footwear. They're the sponsor. I'm wearing them right now. The Everyday Move shoes. They're known for being lightweight, easy to pack, comfortable, and most importantly, water resistant, because they got Dymatex technology. You know what that is. These Everyday Move shoes, the whole line is designed with added support in the midsole and better breathability to keep up with your active lifestyle. Because you're on the move, running from movie theater to movie theater, listening to podcasts on the go. You can take them off and put them back on with ease thanks to the handy pull tab. You know, the laces don't matter. I love slip-ons. They're also made creature-free, so every step you take will be guilt-free. Except for that other stuff on your conscience.
It's the shoes where something's made up and the laces don't matter.
Your feet will thank you for wearing these. So say goodbye to wet socks and check them out at vessi.com/TJM and use the code TJM.
TJM.
Thanks to Manscaped for sponsoring today's episode. Manscaped's Lawnmower 4.0 is designed to keep your family jewels safe with their ceramic blades featuring skin-safe tech to reduce nicks and cuts. Leave the cables at home with its new wireless charging system that's compatible with most Qi charging pads. It's cordless, it's waterproof, it gets 90 minutes of use on a full charge, so head to manscaped.com/TJM20 and get 20% off today. And guess what, Riley?
Yes?
Free shipping.
No
G on there, just shipping.
Shipping?
Thanks to NIU for sponsoring today's video. Their BQI C3 Pro is the evolution of the urban e-bike. Whether you're commuting across the city on the daily or a weekend warrior exploring the parks outside of town, the BQI C3 Pro will get you where you're going quickly and safely. Unless you drive like an idiot, it offers up to 62 miles in range, swappable battery capabilities for extended range, and comes in three colors: white, glossy gray, which is me as a color, and matte black. Get 20% off the NIU BQI-C3 Pro from November 17th to December 4th. Plus, for the most avid riders, a chance to win an additional 50% off. What do you got to do to qualify for that? I don't know. Click the link below and find out.
I don't know. Let me know.
That's it. You tell us in the comments, you avid rider.
That's the sequel to Midnight Rider.
Avid Rider. I don't know what that
is. You know that song too?
No.
Allman Brothers, man. Come on.
I was trying to follow you.
You're great at that.
Do you want to know what happened in the movie?
Yeah. A lot.
It's a shorter one. It's short synopsis because not much happens.
It's so much.
Professional thief Neil McCauley, played by Robert De Niro, is planning one last big heist before retiring, but he's hindered by the betrayal of new crew member Wayne Grow and a blooming romance with bookstore worker Edie. That hinders his heist? I don't know about that. But meanwhile, Lieutenant Vincent Hanna, played by Al Pacino, attempts to track down McCauley as he deals with his troubled wife Justine and stepdaughter Lauren. Despite their conflict, Hannah invites McCauley to get a coffee, and they discover a mutual respect, even as they try to thwart each other's plans. When the big heist goes wrong, most of McCauley's crew is killed, but he manages to get away with enough money to escape LA with Edie scot-free. But after learning of Wayne Grow's location at a hotel, he leaves Edie in his car and kills Wayne Grow. I'm skipping a lot here, as you can see. Hannah spots
to the end of the movie.
Hannah spots McCauley before he returns, and McCauley abandons Edie, chased by Hannah. McCauley is eventually shot by Hannah, who takes McCauley's hand as he dies. Look, I didn't have time to put in all the subplots with all the secondary characters.
We had a 600-word synopsis for a while.
There's a lot that goes on, but I'd argue that the core narrative, the one that is the reason why I gave it those 5.5 points, is this relationship between McCauley and
Hannah. The only plot that matters to me is Al Pacino and his love affair with that TV.
Oh yeah, that's awesome.
He's like they had to have bigger TVs in 1995.
It was just in a little like office off the kitchen.
Yeah, but he's like, this is my precious TV.
Yeah,
this is like, probably because that's what he brought into her apartment.
Yeah. He's like, I have to bring in something of my own because it's the ex-husband's house.
There was a lot of comments on our previous video about Heat because they had heard that we were going to do it.
Uh-huh.
And there's a few people in there saying like, oh, I just already watched Heat in anticipation of the next episode. And man, it's awesome. Everybody watch it. Everyone, Riley's wrong. This movie's so dope.
What did said Riley's wrong?
They knew you were going to be off on this one.
You could see it.
The reason I bring this up though is because the synopsis, it is one of those movies, almost like The Dark Knight. Like, there's just which we were talking
the
about last
Dark Knight,
time.
Yeah.
Like, there's just so much stuff that
goes
on.
There's way too much going on.
There's all these little side... I actually, one of my notes, I was like, this is almost like Magnolia with all these different characters.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote down that it could be a TV show. Feel like this could be a really good TV show.
There's a dude who ends up being the driver. He ends up being the driver and just getting shot, the getaway driver for the final heist. But not only do they set up this character, like the normal movie thing to do would be to set up this character in one scene, and then his second scene would be getting asked to be the driver.
Yeah.
But they do him one better. They give him two setup scenes. So we're like totally invested in this guy. Yeah. We have no idea how he fits into the plot or anything with any other characters for the first like hour that we have seen him. And then suddenly it connects like, hey, what about that guy you went to jail with before? Go ask him.
Yeah.
And then, so it's cool because later on when he does get involved, you have your familiarity and there's some kind of stakes there. You care about him at least a bit. But before he gets involved, you're just like, what are we doing? Why am I watching this guy?
Yeah.
All right. It's a 6.5.
Yeah. I feel like begins.
It's interesting.
Reminding me of like there are a number of moments of that made me think. Go.
I think it's interesting that the movie has spent so much time on these subplots because I think the central tension is the most interesting, that you have this cop who's, you know, aggressive and brash and like he's off the rails, whereas
Al Pacino.
The thief is the cool, calculated one. And I think that's a novel angle to take. And we've seen it like in recent years, but I feel like in 1995, that was like that alone could carry the
movie. It's interesting because it kind of pushes them both to the center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes them more similar to each other. Like the most outrageous cop has the qualities of a criminal. The most outrageous criminal has the qualities of a cop. You know, so another thing that's cool about the dynamics in this movie is like they're really elegant in the way they're set up. Like, for example, you know, in any heist movie, there's got to be high stakes to do the heist. Mm-hmm. You know, this is going to be the last job. I'll be able to retire my family, whatever. There's just all these inherent, implicit kind of benefits and stakes when it's like all this money.
Yep.
But the way they do it in this movie around the character played by Val Kilmer, Chris. His whole thing is he's like a gambler and his wife's going to leave him, but he has this one opportunity, this one last chance, right?
Yeah.
To like score big, and then maybe he doesn't gamble that away and then they live happily ever after.
That's how addiction works for sure.
Yeah, with his kid. But the thing is, it's when that stake is set up, it's not set up between Chris and his wife. It's set up between the De Niro character, Neil, and Chris's wife, which is so sweet and subtle in what it does for the movie because the stakes there that like Val Kilmer has this one last chance, like, hey, just give him one more chance. Don't leave him yet. She doesn't know, but Val Kilmer's character, Chris, is about to get the biggest score of his life. And when that happens, it's all going to be good.
Yeah.
Just trust me on this.
When you say score, you mean?
The heist, the money.
Oh, the actual heist.
The money
he's
going to get. I
thought you meant the score of like his wife giving him another chance.
No. Like his wife doesn't know, but he's about to get this big.
Oh, his wife doesn't know.
His wife doesn't know, but he's about to get this money. Yeah. And once he does, he can smarten up and everything, right? Because Neil's like kind of, you know, role model for Chris or whatever. But the thing that's sweet from a story crafting perspective is what they've just done is now this high stake interaction isn't about Chris. It's about Neil. Mm-hmm. Neil's reputation's on the line. Neil's carrying this himself. Yeah. He has to pull off the heist because he put on himself Chris's marriage on the line, right? And now it's all about the protagonist.
Yeah.
And I would argue, even though this is kind of, there's a dual thing between De Niro and Pacino, it is Neil who's the protagonist in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that earlier as well, but it's definitely Neil. I mean, we follow him and it's the obstacles that have to be overcome are like his basically. Like Vincent is just trying to catch them the whole time, but like it's not like he doesn't make like huge decisions.
What do you think that Neil's arc would be?
Neil's arc is he's trying to go from lone wolf to someone who has no attachments to someone who has meaning in his life, because he looks around at everyone else in his crew and they all have family. Mm. They have things they don't want to leave in the 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Right.
And so he goes, oh, maybe I could get some of that and have like some kind of meaning in my life.
And you think that's his fatal sin at the end, is that he does not change? Like he leaves her?
He doesn't sacrifice the things that need to be sacrificed in order to have that happiness. Like he gets fixated on this revenge thing, right? Mm-hmm. But another test to see who's the protagonist is who's more active and who's more reactive. If you look at like Pacino is only like, if De Niro's character doesn't do the heist, What does Vincent Pacino's character do? He just stays home. There's nothing for him to do. It's all in the hands of De Niro's character.
And his capable hands they are. I think that crew is friggin' awesome.
That's a sick crew.
They do such a good job introducing them and introducing like how professional they are. Every action they take is so careful and calculated. Even that, I think that first heist is a 10 out of 10. I think it's fucking fantastic. The build up to it, you know, he's like just walking through the hospital, getting into the ambulance, like, oh, interesting. And then Val Kilmer calmly buying the explosives. You know, it's just like these little setups, like a mission in GTA 5 where you have to
get
all this stuff. And then you get to the heist.
It's so expertly done, too, because they chose for him to have to walk through this hospital. There's all this beeping and clatter going around and all this. And then you actually characterize his character through that walk, because what does he do when he gets to the door? He opens the door not by using the door handle, but by using the handicap button that automatically opens the door. And he doesn't hit it with his hand, he hits it with his elbow. So you're already like, oh, he doesn't want to leave any traces. Like he's a calculated person.
That cool the stunt of like flipping over the armored truck and stuff. I feel like that was really thrilling, and it was a really cool like high stakes stunt to start the movie off with.
I think a smart design for that stunt too is having it next to a car lot, because seeing how that thing pushes through cars really gives you a sense of the weight.
Yeah,
I think we get so numb to, you know, big things in movies. Like if that thing just slid on a road and, you know, stopped at a building, we'd be like, oh, that's cool. But the fact that it is pushed over and slides and pushes over like 10 cars is actually like, wow, that thing's heavy.
It's funny. And the other thing they do is when they let off that explosive, you get to see not just a couple of windows blow out, but you get to see like 20 windows blow out. There's a whole car lot there.
It's a big like stunt that I think nowadays they probably wouldn't go to the trouble of like doing all of that practically. But I think that like seeing a movie from 1995 basically have no option but to do this all practically. Like nowadays it would probably just be like, I don't know, CGI explosions
pushed
and stuff,
off a bridge
and, like,
or something.
But like here it almost had like sort of a more budget movie feel, where you can kind of see the rigs like pushing cars around and stuff. And that was a really cool stunt.
It's cool because it's not like over the top. It's like it's really grounded in something that I think my brain can process. And so it feels so real.
It's between Speed and a Scorsese movie. It's right in the middle there. Kind of a sweet spot for me. I think that's awesome.
I think that after being spoiled by like so much spectacle now in blockbuster movies, seeing a movie that is a blockbuster, but well, at least at that point, it showed a little bit of restraint.
I feel like when they showed that giant truck, I felt simultaneously the influences and the influenced. Like, because you talked about Christopher Nolan saying that he watched Heat a lot during the filming of Dark Knight. Dark Knight's like inspired by Heat. So I saw that semi and I just was reminded of the Joker semi truck set piece.
So that's so funny, because during the robbery later, the big heist, I was like, was Dark Knight inspired by this? Because this scene
he
feels
said
a lot
that on
like
our last episode.
Riley doesn't listen when I talk. He just
what do you mean? He said what? That there's a scene that
he said everything
Nolan,
I just said.
Christopher Nolan watched Heat every day when he made the Dark Knight.
I mean, that was the end of the episode. I had to pee like crazy. Remember? I had to leave early because I had to pee.
No,
so
that's fine.
But the other influenced is I wondered if the James Cameron Terminator 2 big semi truck through LA, the LA River. I was like, man, semis. When there's less CG, semis are great.
Yeah,
that's true.
When they're scary, they're so big. I find threats that are easy to tie to the real world are much more interesting. Having a giant monster, you're like, that's scary. But a semi like
smashing,
smashing stuff, you're like, I could be dead.
You're like, I've seen a semi before.
The way they shoot the inside of that truck, the people being tossed around, you're like, oh God, that looks awful.
Yeah.
And their ears are bleeding. I love when they line up the security guards and they're like, they're not planning on killing them. No. But like the one dude is, you know, his ears are bleeding. The guy's pointing his gun, yelling at him. The guy's like, can't you see the blood in his fucking ears? He's dead. Yeah. But the guy, you know, Wingro
is slick.
He's losing. He's just like, he's a hot-headed guy. Yeah. So he's like, he's not a pro like the other people.
He's low level.
And so he shoots them. And then the other ones, no hesitation, you know, they just had like, we have to kill them. And it tells you so much about that crew. And it's so thrilling.
Yeah. And even if you can't figure that out in the moment, Vincent's character tells you later that now they've murdered one, the punishment they're going to get for killing the rest won't increase, but the risk of being having those witnesses alive.
Yeah,
what can bring you down? So you have you might as well just kill them. It's like the right move.
I love that. Heist. When I love it quote too, unquote. Like even just the simple things, like they don't pull up, you know, a bunch of cash out. Like they pull this drawer and they're looking for this one thing. You don't know what it is, and it just changes. Yeah. You know, like they're pros.
Well,
they're,
that characterizes them too.
It's surgical. Yeah, yeah. It's not brute force, and I just love it.
I really appreciate how all the like operations that they do are like they have a plan and they're just executing on the plan like flawlessly. Mm-hmm. I feel like I would appreciate like a little bit of seeing the planning. It felt a little bit too like magical. Like they just are amazing, and they.
You mean for the other heists that come up later?
Yeah, like when they break into the metal factory or whatever that is, and they like have all the tools ready and they know exactly what to do. I mean, he talked to that guy. We see him talking to that guy about how like you hack the system. Jonathan Voight.
Oh no, the guy, the computer guy,
the hacker guy. But. I don't know. It regardless, I that would make the movie even longer, which I don't want to do.
But I hear you because it's. I don't think this is like a heist movie in the same way that like Ocean's 11 is a heist movie, where it's building up to this one big heist and they're setting it up and like.
I thought it was, and then when the heist happened and I saw there was another hour left, I was like, oh, I guess that's not a heist movie.
No, and I think the movie its peaks for me are the heist, but. It's
for sure.
It's not the point of the movie. It's a character thing.
Do you want to rattle off? Do you have any more Dark Knight similarities you noticed? Like for example, in that first heist, they're wearing those hockey masks.
Yeah,
they got in Dark Knight. They have those Joker masks in the first heist.
That the banker from the Dark Knight's in it.
Yeah, that was a sweet cameo. That had to be an homage.
It must be.
You know who we're talking about?
Van Zandt.
Van Zandt in this movie.
William Fichtner.
In the opening scene of The Dark Knight, there's like a bank owner guy, and he says something like, don't you criminals understand, or why can't you learn this? He has a shotgun, doesn't he? Doesn't he have like lower shotgun?
Yeah.
It must have been an homage.
I can't imagine it's not. There's a lot of like visual, you know, echoes, stuff that if you put them side by side, that's like, oh, that looks inspired. You know, even the fact that De Niro's apartment, you know, it's like the way he looks out of it, it's very similar to Christian Bale looking out of his apartment. There's lots of like these feelings, similar shots.
That really stood out to me, it was a shot where you've got it might have been a semi truck or a vehicle in heat, what is going down the road like towards a heist or towards some main event, and there's just like an aerial tracking shot of it, and the soundtrack is really minimal. That's exactly like before the Joker semi-truck scene, where you just have like this kind of like in the background, and it's just setting up for this big pressure that's about to mount.
Yeah, I think visually there's a lot of echoes. I think the sound design, I'm guessing that he pulled a lot from it, because I think the sound effects in this movie are very so impactful.
And I noticed it in like the first scenes, even just the footstep sounds. And when he's walking through the hospital, he closed the door, and I was like, that is not just the door sound. Like that's a custom door.
They did work
in this movie.
They do
a bespoke door.
I think they do a fantastic job with the Foley and really raising it in the mix so that you're kind of drawn into like the little detail, like the clothes and like you said, the door. And then all of a sudden, like there'll be like gunshots or explosions and they just like shake you to your core. They're so fucking loud.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The dynamic range in this movie is huge. If you got people sleeping or whatever, you got to turn it up and turn it down a lot.
There's Christopher Nolan echoes.
Yeah. Well, it has David Fincher echoes too, in that like there's a baby crying and you're like, surround left speaker, you gotta pause it and see if it's in your house or like sirens and shit.
Yeah,
like it's really well mixed.
It's really, man, I think the best part of the sound mix is the bank heist when they start firing. There's something about like the way the gunshots make me feel that makes me want to be a sound designer, because it's like these gunshots have like desperation in them. Like there's like something more to it than just like being loud. It's like they're sad gunshots. I can't explain it.
I feel like part
you can
of
hear
it,
the ambient, like the area around the gunshots. You can, the way that the echoes go off, you can tell they're in a parking garage.
Yeah, it feels so real.
Well, I feel like especially in that like ridiculous huge shootout, like they're just unloading, like they all have machine guns
at least
every time they shoot it's like and it's like, whoa,
at
geez.
Least they have magazines all over their bodies, though.
That's one
thing that is a nitpick for me in movies all the time, because I've shot a full auto weapon before and it took like three seconds, maybe less,
to empty
the clip. And I think the clip only had a magazine of like 25 rounds.
Yeah.
But like it's so fast. So as soon as someone's like, brah, 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 it's like you're empty. That's
it. Yeah.
And I think starting it off with death, too. And then all of a sudden, like the stakes are real. You're like, oh, main characters are going to die in this. And like, The other dude dies. And,
wait, what? Early on? Who dies?
Well, in the heist. In the heist scene, when the driver dies and then...
Right.
Yeah, but you're so disposable.
Yeah.
but at the same time, he wasn't, though, because you, like, cared about his
plight. Well, yeah, they spent so much time investing into him.
What are you talking about? Oh, I thought you were talking about in the early, in the first part of the movie.
In the bank heist. And then they kill the other, other teammate, and then...
Right.
Everybody, Danny Trejo.
A lot of people die.
Danny Trejo, man, he got done dirty in this movie. Yeah. Apparently, that was his first role.
Huh.
And he wasn't even supposed to be in it, so...
But they call him Trejo, right?
So yeah, that's his character's name.
It's so random.
They just, like, took his name.
He's underutilized, though.
I want to
talk... It's like he's only in the movie so that they can switch out the driver later and have, like, a variable there or something. Or maybe they just liked him and they made that whole plot for that.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, there are some, not to get too woke this early, but there are some kind of, like, weird things of the era in here. Like, the fact that, okay, the one minority betrays them and then the other minority gets killed first and... The women are like...
Who betrays them?
Trejo betrays them.
Trejo?
But he, I think they think he betrays them.
No, he does.
He does,
actually? Well, I mean, he has to because they have his wife.
Mm.
Okay.
They kidnap his wife, and then he has no choice but to betray them.
The thing that I found that stood up to me in terms of, like, 2022 lens is how they characterize Val Kilmer. And I think if you characterize him the same way, early on, you see him, like, you know, be abusive towards his wife, like, throw stuff, smash things.
Mantrum.
And in 1995, you know, you're like, wow, you know, he's under a lot of pressure. He's under a lot of pressure. Whereas 2022, you're like, holy shit, that guy needs to be taken out. Like, there is no coming back from that.
Do not live with your kid.
Yeah. And so I thought that was interesting.
You think that in 1995, he'd be taken out? Or
no? No. In 2022, you're like, it's irredeemable. Fuck that guy. He's a monster.
Right. That would be them telling us that this guy's the bad guy. But in this movie, it's saying...
He's flawed.
He's just young and he's trying his best.
Under a lot of pressure. I think that's the perfect...
Yeah, she's cheating on him, man.
Well,
With Mo from The Simpsons.
Yeah, that's Azaria, right?
Yeah, it's weird. It's always weird seeing him in movies it's hard to take him seriously. He's good as a Weasley guy, I guess.
Yeah, in this movie, he just stands there with his mouth open.
He's
looking
like, hey, come on, I'm just trying to do the thing. Boom, boom, boom.
He's just like looking at Pacino in awe, like, how did I get wrapped up in this?
Oh, that's my favorite moment in the entire movie, though. He's like, why did I get into this? Because she's got a great ass!
Pacino's so unhinged. It's like his whole thing is just going too extremely loud out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I wrote down,
he's like weaponized Italianism.
Is his acting, like, there are parts where I'm just like, this is kind of bad, but then it's like, it's Al Pacino being kind of unhinged, which is sort of the whole reason you bring in Al Pacino to do something like this. Like, there's the other line where he's like, you're talking to so-and-so. Who? What are you, a fucking owl? I'm like, come on.
That's right out of The Departed.
Get out of here.
Yeah, it's tough. Actors like that are so iconic, it's hard to, later in their careers, or even now that he's like an 80-year-old man, we've seen a million performances of him. You just recognize the tools that he uses, and he uses them often.
Yeah.
And the same, I find, like, Leo DiCaprio is the same. He's a great actor, but you start to recognize the tools, and you're like, uh-huh.
Right,
and he
right,
becomes
right.
a parody of himself, even though they're still excellent actors.
But if you go back to 95, though, don't waste my fucking time! Yeah. It's, like, awesome.
Yeah. It's like, I can make this more interesting if I just start accentuating something and say, ass!
His character introduction confused me, because it was like, everyone else... Like, you're seeing De Niro walk through and he's cool and calculating. He's not leaving prints behind. And then you see Val Kilmer is buying weapons and shit. Like, and then you go to Vincent, he's just making out with his wife, just passionately.
Well, that was weird.
Making love.
It's weird. It's like, I find the movie visually, I think aesthetics wise, is fantastic, but sometimes it baffles me some of the decisions. Like, the first frame of Al Pacino, his head is like half hidden behind a white sheet. And like, that's where his wife is, where he's making out with her. But like, the first frame of him, he's like making out behind a white sheet. Like, why are they choosing that instead of like later in the same shot when you can see her?
That scene was confusing as to why it went on that long and also why it was there in the first place. Because their relationship is not really characterized as primarily like a sexual relationship. They don't ever get sexual again.
She calls him bestial or bestial.
Yeah.
And he was woman. So like, maybe they're trying to show him like he's animalistic.
Mm-hmm.
But
he's also so cerebral. So it's like,
but she calls him like a hunter, like a predator.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of thought maybe they're just trying to set him up as someone with something to lose.
Because
his first scene is him and his wife and then his stepdaughter. It's like, he has things to lose. De Niro doesn't have anything to lose.
This feels like an HBO show where they have to they have to give you the goods because
and they're
part
making
of the reason,
out. Like their little tongues are flicking around.
They're doing stuff.
There's a little
half the
there.
Reason you go yeah. watch an HBO show, I assume, is because of all the boobs and butts and dick dongs.
Don't forget about the dick dongs.
Don't forget.
That's
so,
why
like,
it's called HBO Hard Butters Only.
Yeah, so they have to give it to you early or else mm-hmm. you're like, why am I paying for the subscription? Okay. I want the good stuff.
It is interesting that it's young Natalie Portman. I don't
like a
really
kid.
Why did that make
yeah, segue from the good stuff to young Natalie Portman. Teenage Natalie.
I think
yuck,
it's
dude.
Oh my god, you guys are
we're moving on. It's yes. in the family. Next family member.
What do you think
she gets
her,
hot later though?
Okay.
Oh my goodness. What do you think the purpose of that entire story about her is for? What do you think it accomplishes? That like eventually she'll try to kill herself and he, you know, he saves her and he does the right thing, brings her to the hospital and stuff. But like,
I think, I guess it, plot-wise it or character-wise it served as a way for their family unit to remain connected because they were kind of like drifting apart and then, oh, something horrible happens and we come together to support each other in the wake of a tragedy. So that it serves that purpose.
No, but what is the purpose of that? I think what it comes down to,
because we have all these like overly complicated plots in a 3-hour movie.
It comes down to these two characters, right? We want to know how far they'll go, right? So we know that De Niro is breaking his own rules by getting in a relationship with Edie. So what's the mirror image of that is, will Pacino or Vincent, will he sacrifice his whole family for his job? Or does he have a line where he's like, no, okay, now I need to be here for my family at the expense of my job? How dedicated is he? How obsessed is he?
But do you think that scene or that setup successfully demonstrates that it's at the cost of his like job or his obsession? To me, it feels like so separate from the risk of the heist and being a policeman. Like, it's just like he comes home, she's in the bathtub, he's got to save her. It's not like it's the stake is her or
he doesn't need to make a decision in that case. He goes into the
where Christopher Nolan did it better with the Two-Face thing. You know, Batman had to choose,
right? I mean, Vincent is not making a choice. He's just reacting to the fact that his stepdaughter is in his tub bleeding out, so he needs to save her.
Yeah, but he's waiting in the emergency room with, what's his wife's name? Justine. And they're staying there, and his pager goes off, and he's like, whatever, I'm going to stay here. And then
she dismisses him
eventually and allows him to go.
I don't think the conflict is ever like whether he cares about his family or not. I think he cares about...
What are you talking
about?
It's his obsession. She says the whole conflict with his wife is... You said you were gonna share. I was gonna share you with crime, but instead I get the leftovers.
Well, yeah, but I don't think his affection for his family or his love for his family is ever in question. I had never questioned it. I was like, he obviously cares about them. He obviously finds value.
Yeah, but it's a hierarchy. It's priorities.
Well, the argument that he's making is that he cares about them a lot, and it's not about like, okay, am I going to sacrifice my work in order to spend time with the family? It's more about, listen, I care about you a lot, and this is what I have available for a family based on my work. Like, I can't stop chasing the criminals and let the world go to shit in order to spend time with you, right?
You
like, that's his argument. It's not that he, like, doesn't care enough about them to spend time with them. It's that he literally doesn't have time to spend with them. So when a horrible thing happens, he jumps into action because he cares about them. They are his family.
Well, it's about him being the best, though, right? So when he goes to a 2 a.m. meeting with an informant who may or may not have information, it's like he could not do that. Like,
did that happen?
Like a lesser cop. Yeah, remember he goes to that one guy who he says, don't waste my fucking time. And that guy's like, meet my brother Richard at 2 a.m. at this bar. And then he goes and meets Richard.
Oh,
and
sure.
Richard's like, yeah, you called this guy slick all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
That whole meeting.
Yeah.
Maybe someone who's less obsessed or less dedicated would have just not done that.
I feel like the movie didn't show us that.
Do you think
showing that he's like not generally available, but I don't think that specific scenario. Anyway.
Do you think that part of the dynamic they're trying to demonstrate is that Al Pacino's like worse at compartmentalizing and like brings family into work and work into family in the way that Robert De Niro doesn't?
I think that the movie is exploring this hyper-masculine idea that you have to completely separate the realm of work and home, and you can't talk to your wife about your work. He says this to her straight up. He's like, I can't let you in on all the demons that I'm fraternizing with in my brain. I need
that angst.
Right.
Is what he said. I thought that was really a cool monologue.
I need to keep that for myself. I can't share that with you.
Do you think there really was a microwaved baby?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, and that was great.
You mean,
I
mean, in the lore?
In the lore.
Yeah. In the lore, yeah.
In the universe,
think,
yeah.
I think that that was a great anecdote because it really did like shock the audience and shock her into realizing the shit that he deals
with. You don't
want
to know,
because,
lady.
Because, but you know, again, I think that this is sort of like a point against the movie in some ways, because it's like, oh, women can't understand. Women can't understand the struggles of men. And men need to go out here and do the the hard things and the masculine things, and women just need to follow along and don't ask questions. It's like that seems to be kind of like the tack that the movie takes, and that annoyed me.
Mm.
Because even in the 90s, we had, you know, a bit more like equal takes, where it's like, okay, if you're a woman, you don't necessarily have to be the housewife on the porch saying, guys, come in, stop playing around, stop roughhousing.
I think you've identified the line. In the 90s, no, you didn't have to do that. She has a job in this movie. But
she has a job, but she's also, like, I don't know, kind of useless. She's on Prozac.
Exactly. That's the 90s.
Right.
That's, like, how woke they were.
What was the woke? That she has a job?
Yeah.
But not is not a proactive member of this movie.
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, like, when did The Matrix come out?
99.
99.
4 years later.
Fair enough.
Changed everything. what do you guys feel when the movie sets up, you know, the two opposing forces having dinner? Do you feel like it worked? Because it's kind of like the probably the time the movie's clearest.
Coffee date?
No, they go for dinner, don't they?
They get a coffee.
Well, they say they get a coffee, but it's nighttime and they're at a restaurant.
Yeah, whatever.
Do you feel like the movie successfully sets it up in a way you believe? And do you think that the discussion they have is a good kind of like bringing the themes to their head, or did it feel contrived? Like, how did it feel to you guys?
I freaking loved that scene.
Okay.
That was like the high point of the movie for me. I loved having this like whole conflict set up, and they like make
each
other. It's
like an unstoppable object meets a movable force.
Well, not even that. I think they're not even like opposites in that way. They are like the same person. And I think that was like beautiful to see.
They're just
kindred spirits.
They're trying
on
to get across.
Sides.
It's like we're the same with a different.
They're both obsessed
context.
With their work. They are bad at maintaining attachments. You know, they don't feel like they can be normal. Mm-hmm. And I
respect you, but I'll kill you.
Yeah,
that's basically the TLDR.
I really loved that scene, and I especially love it in the context of like being set up by the scene previous where the criminals find out that they're being tailed. They like go to that shipping container dock or whatever, and then the cops come in and they're like, oh, I think they made us, and it shows like De Niro up there with the camera, and it's like, okay, now we set up the two opposing sides, and they know about each other, they know about this war,
yeah,
and now they're coming to the middle of no man's land to parlay, and I thought that was just
That's
it was
fine.
Great. Yeah.
It's also cool that they have this like there's all this pretense. Like when he gets pulled over, the moment is just pregnant with pretense of like unsaid, I know who you are, you know who I am, I'm pulling you over, I have nothing on you.
Yeah.
And he just says, do you want to get a cup of coffee?
It was it was beautifully unexpected. Mm-hmm. And then they go for coffee and I'm just like, this is super interesting.
That scene is Batman interrogating Joker.
Yeah.
Well, not even
right?
because...
Is that when they first are face to face in Dark Knight?
I think this is the first time they're face to face. I feel like that happens a little earlier in the movie compared to Heat. Heat, that's it's not the halfway point.
Heat is around the halfway
point. I think that is the midpoint.
Okay,
midpoint.
Okay, then yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of movie after.
Yeah, there is.
I guess you could draw a parallel there. I feel like the Batman Joker situation is like less compelling because Joker is being held captive.
Mm-hmm.
And in this situation, Hannah is inviting him, do you want to come to a cup of coffee? And he's like, sure. He could say no. You know,
could he
just be like, fuck off, cop. I ain't doing that with you, you know? Yeah. But I think that because Hannah knows that he's a smart guy and he's respecting him, you know, it's like he's trying to catch him and put him away. But at the same time, the movie continually reiterates that he has this respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what's his name? Vincent? Neil has a respect for Hannah, for Vincent.
Yeah. Vincent Hannah.
I think Al Pacino and Robert De Niro are one of the all-time greatest acting couples in the sense that, like, they're... Like, Al Pacino is such an external actor and De Niro is such an internal actor. And so their energies just work so well when he's like, when De Niro's talking to him and De Niro just, you know, keeps it in, but he's like emoting so much so subtly.
Yeah.
It's
fantastic. He's doing that like,
Yeah. And you can tell he's like, he's affected by it, but he's trying not to show it. But he just does
huge,
it so good.
Huge hit pick for me was when they're driving to the airport and he's thinking about Wayne Grove. And we see on his face, it's so funny. It's so subtle too.
Yeah.
And I was so impressed by De Niro, like getting this message across just through these tiny little facial movements and stuff. And I'm like, I can see.
You can't let it go.
So well that you are super conflicted. And then you just like, he can't, yeah,
my
can't
favorite
do it.
De Niro moment in this movie is when he gets to, he successfully gets into Wingo's hotel room. And I think I like that whole setup, you know, him getting in, pulling the fire alarm, all that stuff works. But when he's just like, look at me. Look at me. And he shoots him in the face. I'm like, ooh, that's nice.
I knew that the only reason he wanted him to look at him was because he's like, I want you to look at me as I
fucking
shoot you.
Which is fucking fantastic.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, he's not a man of passion, or he's seeming not a man of passion, but that's like how heated he'll ever be.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic.
Ugh. This movie, the way the pressure mounts in this movie, it was at 38 minutes in, they just keep adding to the pile. Like, they're getting it from all sides. They're getting attacked with, they have this loose end of Wayne Grove. He got away. Yep. So that's just, you know, that's going to turn into some shit. Then they have the threat from Van Zant, who is going to eventually ambush them. There's just all these things coming at them, plus the cops. But at that point, 38 minutes in, you're still not in the lock-in point. Mm. The lock-in point being kind of like the point where the audience knows what the movie's about. You know, the point where you came to see, where you have a hero, you have a goal, you have obstacles, mm-hmm. and you have stakes. And for that, in this movie, that would be like, we know we're going to do the big heist. The cops are after them. All this money and freedom and your family is on the line. Yeah. And it's all like, poosh, now we know where we are. That's like 45, 50 minutes into the movie. So it's like Dark Knight in that way, that it's a four-act movie, I think.
I think that's fair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like, well, I think all of us, we feel that the big heist, you're like, oh, the movie must be close to end, but there's a whole other act after.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Oh, I wanted to say about that meeting, the coffee date. It was like really, really good and I loved it, and I was on such a high during that. But then they're like, hey, well, maybe I shoot you, maybe you shoot me. And it kind of felt like, hey, well, this has been fun, but maybe I'm going to shoot you. Maybe I'm going to shoot you, bada bing. And then I was like, oh, that kind of felt like a weird ending. And then the very next scene is Hannah getting back to the police station, and then they're like, they're all gone. And he's like, what? I was just at the diner with him. Yeah, they're all gone. Ah! And they're just like yelling. I'm like, okay, what? That's really, I don't know. It just kind of ruined the energy.
I feel like my probably weakest group of people is the cops. I feel like they're kind of like a joke in this. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyone but that isn't Hannah is sort of just like,
well, one of them is Buffalo Bill. Did you notice that?
Oh,
the one is Ted Levine or Levine.
Yeah.
The Bosco is the character's name. He's Buffalo Bill.
Oh, of course.
I was looking at him. I was like, I'd fuck him.
A criminal.
I'd fuck him hard.
Nice.
You're
gonna
try and catch a criminal.
You fuck me.
Put the money back in the bank. Yeah.
Was like, I think I give some demerits to the movie, even just how like the movie tries so hard to characterize Al Pacino as like, you know, the best cop, and he's always monologuing and explaining everything to everyone else, and no one else really figures.
He's one of those savants, like,
yeah, and
Sherlock.
It's totally fine, but it I definitely found it a little silly this time, just how useless everyone else is. Even like
it might have worked better in the 90s,
maybe,
but that's like such a cliche now. Yeah. Like this kind of savant cop who's gonna,
I wonder how avoidable it was given that Pacino is so bombastic. It's like, is there any situation,
stole other people's lines?
Well, yeah, maybe. was there any situation in which we would kind of like actually get to know the other cops, because mm-hmm. Pacino's in there, they're like, hey, I have an idea, and he's like, that's the dumbest thing, we gotta go, let's go.
There, later on, you get that one, the one who's the cop who's babysitting Chris's wife, mm-hmm. you get a fair amount from him.
That's fair. He has some stuff to do.
Drecker?
He gets
I like his characterization.
He gets outplayed pretty easy, though. So.
Oh, man. When Chris gets stopped, he cut his hair and has a fake ID.
Yeah,
and that's how he gets away. That's so awesome.
Yeah, I love that. Because you don't know as an audience. You just assume, oh, fuck, they got him. Like, because you think that Ashley Judd, her telling him to go away, that's what's going to save him, and he's going to go away, they'll be fine. But he gets stopped anyway, and you're like, oh no, even though she betrayed herself and her family, you know.
But they're incompetent, because not every cop on the force has been tailing them and knows exactly what he looks like. And I also believe he could have like really great documents, because his whole role on the team the whole time has been this expert who knows how to crack safes.
Well, and even specifically, they show us that he has fake IDs because he gets the explosives.
Oh, man, that's
in the first scene, he has the Arizona State ID.
Yeah, so I just assumed it wasn't his real ID, but I'm catching that now. Yeah, they've given us the hint that he can produce
that's,
fake
you know,
documents.
That's so funny, because I really liked the whole dynamic of like him showing up, and you think that he's gone, and then like Charlene, even though she's pissed at him and doesn't really want to give him another chance, she's like, no,
I don't want you to go
and
jail.
So then at that point, I'm like, okay, this is great. We can just leave this scene now. But then they're like, wait, check him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. And then they're like, yep, his ideas look good. And I'm like, these guys who were brought on for the sole purpose of doing this sting operation to catch one guy, they didn't hand a photo out to be like, this is what he looks like?
Yeah.
Come on.
He cut his hair, man.
They're tasked with checking if this is the guy and they don't know what he looks like. Yeah.
This isn't Val Kilmer. This is Kilmer.
That totally seemed
back
stupid
to your
to me.
Arizona State ID thing, though. I noticed in that first scene he has a wallet, like a Velcro wallet that has an American flag on it.
Oh, interesting.
And actually, I couldn't remember anything from this movie, so I actually thought he was like a hero cop kind of Boy Scout character before learning who he is. And so maybe that's actually part of this setup as well. Like he's creating this identity.
Yeah.
So he's trying to look a certain way because I don't think that character has that damn wallet.
No.
Who are you talking about?
Val Kilmer's character. He does not carry around a Velcro American flag wallet. That's part of a character he's playing to go and buy these explosives.
I did not notice the wallet at all.
Dude, that's the crux of the movie. That's why you
I was hyper-vigilant.
How could you give the movie a low rating if you didn't even look at the wallet? Okay, I just want to talk about like the main plot of the movie. We've mentioned it and we've kind of skirted around it, but like the fact that there's these kindred spirits, you know, both like Hannah and Macaulay are like the same character more or less. I mean, beside one being stoic and the other being like hyperbolic, but did you guys think that there were too many like subplots going on? Because like there's those two guys, there's Chris and Charlene, who's like his wife. There's Charlene and then Hank Azaria's character.
Yeah, but
that's something
going
on.
They all feed into the main one.
There's Justine and Lauren, which are Hannah's wife and stepdaughter. Edie, the romance for Macaulay. Wayne Grow and Van Zant, that's going on. And then we got some scenes of Wayne Grow murdering prostitutes, I guess, so we hate him more.
Yeah, no.
There's Don Breeden, the guy, the parole guy who gets killed in the end, State Farm guy. He's in the State Farm commercials.
Yes.
Treo and his betrayal, and then Nate John Voight. I just feel like there was so many extra characters, and we have scenes with them, and those scenes take a long time to complete.
Yeah.
Well, I think
they all do feed into the main plot, though.
Well, I think, though, I agree they all do, but I think in a tidier movie, those characters interact not just through the central characters, because that's, I think, the problem of this movie is that there's two people at the center, and everyone else interacts to them. And so I think the movie would be well served if the periphery characters started to interact with each other.
You want
other
like
a
mesh topology.
A little bit, just like to tie everything a little bit closer and just, you know, make the movie a little more dense.
Yeah, if there were some more like peripheral connections between some of these side characters, maybe that would be a little bit better. But I think regardless, there's just too much to have in one movie. And I feel like as I was watching this, I said this. I was like, this would be a good TV show. It's okay to have this many subplots and these many narrative threads going
on. I'm going to push back on you, though, because you have Wayne Grow interacting with Van Zant, and Wayne Grow is the one who gets sent to kill Danny Trejo. So there's some cross-pollination there.
There's some cross-pollination, but that's not like, that doesn't take away from the fact that you're trying to stuff this much stuff into one movie.
Yeah, a great example of that is the Wayne Grow as hooker serial killer plot, because it feels weird, and I guess the function of it in the movie is to raise the stakes for the Vincent character, because it's not just about corporate money. Like, he's trying to stop these robbers, right?
Yeah.
And they're just stealing money from businesses that are insured, and like, who really cares if this platinum gets stolen from this metal place or all this money gets stolen from the bank? But when he shows up on that crime scene, there's somebody's baby on the ground dead, and this mom is losing it, and he hugs her, and that's the stakes. Like, Wayne Grow's associated with these people. Stopping these bad guys matters.
Yeah, but the stakes... Okay. Yeah, I just thought that was, like, so superfluous, because we know that Wayne Grow's a bad guy. We see even the first scene that he's a bad guy. He doesn't care about killing these random people. He's trigger-happy. We already know that he's a bad guy. We don't need this whole secondary scene. It took so long to kill the prostitute. And then the mom shows up, and he hugs the mom. We're here for, like, a long time.
Okay, so you're saying it's, like, a hat on a hat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you there. This is up for deletion. This could be a deleted
scene.
And
I'd say...
But I'm not saying that it's a useless scene.
It's completely useless. It would be useful if Wayne Grow and Van Zant and that plot was like the main plot. But it kind of seems like it's going to be a main plot. And then it just gets shuffled to the side because the real thing is between Vincent and Nicole, which is a better one in my opinion. I like that story better. But I'm like, pick a lane. You got to... I feel like if this movie was more focused... I would be happier with it.
But because what I'm telling you here is
trying for a shotgun approach.
The Wayne Gross stuff is about Vincent.
No, it's not. We know he's a bad guy, and they know Gros' location early on. They could take down Wayne Gros early on anytime, but they leave him there as
it feeds into why does Vincent do this job? Why does he sacrifice what he sacrifices to do this job?
Why is he a cop in general?
Why is he a cop to the degree that he's a cop? All that stuff. It's the stakes for him.
It's going from stopping, you know, cold heists that aren't like, you know, taken away from corporations to a very human thing.
I'd say that then you either have the conversation where he's explaining to his wife about the microwaved baby, or you have the Wayne Gros killing the hooker and him having to hug the thing. Like, we don't need multiple scenes.
But I also think like they maybe get rid of the baby microwaving thing. But I think Wayne Gros going from, you know, apathetic sociopath who kills because he's annoyed with this guy to someone who takes pleasure in killing a sexual partner, that's a different level of like psych, being a psychopath.
I feel like, again, was a TV show, it would be totally fine. Mm-hmm.
So
it's a movie.
Do you think it plays any part in our satisfaction as an audience? Like, when Neil decides to go and kill Wayne Gros at the end, we want to feel like that was the right call for him to make.
I think so. And I think that it succeeds at doing that. Because if all we saw was him killing a guard and going away and then betraying them, you'd be like, yeah, fuck that guy. But now you're like, fuck that guy. Yeah. I want him like three bullets
in
the
brain. But Neil doesn't even know that he killed that girl.
I think that's a mistake. I think that's another example of the movie would be better served if periphery characters kind of interacted a little bit. Because the audience knows those stakes, but you're right, Neil doesn't.
I'm pretty sure he doesn't.
I don't think so either.
I mean, in that moment, the audience is supposed to be conflicted because we know that we want Wayne Gros to die.
Yeah, we hate him.
But we also are
rooting for him to get out of there, right?
You know, as soon as he turns that car, like takes that exit, you're like, it's over.
We
that's
know that
your fatal flaw.
The right thing for him to do is to, well, turn himself in. But the other right thing for him to do is to get the hell out of there with Edie and start a new life away from all this.
The thing, though, is he's never set up as a vindictive character, really. Or is he? What do you think? Like, it's his fatal flaw in this movie. The fact that he doesn't get away with everything and have the life that he wants is because he needs to get this revenge.
Well, I think it's because his friends have died because of him and because of Wayne Gros. Like, he knows whatever the one dude who dies when he's carrying the kid, like, that's someone he's worked with for years and years and is, like, loyal to the death to him. And because of Wayne Gros, he's dead. And so I think, like, it's not just they betrayed him. It's that he is directly responsible for the death of his friends and family.
I think I respect the movie for giving sort of a realistic take there, where when you are in this life, you're like, as we talked about during The Godfather or whatever,
loyalty.
You can have an internal sense of morals, quote unquote, but they're all fucked up because you're experiencing all of this cognitive dissonance. You think that you have internal morals, but then you constantly break the rules and you constantly exist outside of society. Mm-hmm. You're like an anarchist, really. So like, he's like, I know what I should do. But when you've lived in a world where you're not doing what you should do, you're doing what you want to do, mm-hmm. and you're breaking moral rules all the time, you're not able to think properly, and you're not able to hold this idea in your head that like, don't do this, even though I really want to do it, but I shouldn't. He's not able to parse that because he's a master criminal. So like, he's like, I like that the movie tells you that, and then he pays the price for it because he has lived this life of complete immorality, and he gets the consequences.
And I love how Edie is his opposite in every way, including this way, because she's like, she's just his opposite. Like, she's not a city slicker like him, really. She's got that cute accent, and she's so wholesome and like innocent. And then when she finds out that he's a criminal, she just wants to rebuke him so much, and like her whole being. But then she does a little judgment error as well, and decides to go with him.
I feel like she's just like, that's like Stockholm syndrome. She like tries to run away. He literally physically tackles her and restrains her and brings her back. She keeps asking him when she's allowed to leave. And he's like, oh, well, you can leave whenever you want.
Leave right now.
But can she? Because she tried to leave and he didn't let her. It's like, it's fucking abuse. I mean, like, okay, it's 1995. They had different ideas. of this stuff.
When you fly to another country with me, then you'll be able to leave
easily. But I think
easily.
I was just like, I don't know. It was really hard for me to separate. It was really hard for me to watch this story and not be like, okay, I'm supposed to be cheering. I'm supposed to be sort of like on Macaulay's side here, but really I'm just pissed at him because you think that you can live this life and have what you want, and you can't.
Yeah, but I think he knows that, and that's the sin of the movie. And like, that's the sin he commits, is that he tries to have both.
And I also just thought it was like super unrealistic for this, like, she's a bookstore worker. You know, she's kind of like a quiet.
She's bookish.
She's bookish. She's kind of quiet. She's a normal person. She's not involved in this crazy life. And then she realizes that he's a horrible criminal. And she's just like, okay, you just murdered a bunch of people. And then you come to my house running from the cops. And she's like, okay, but you're not going to do it again, right? Like, come on.
Man, as soon as he invited her to go to New Zealand, I was like, he's going to die.
Oh, yeah.
As soon as he says that, come away with me. This is what we're going to do at the end of the movie. I'm like, no, you're not.
No, you're not. You're dead.
That's done.
What do you guys think of that ending at the airport where they're like fighting in the shadows?
That's kind of, it's similar, I think, to a movie from Michael Mann that I watched part of as a teenager. Definitely fell asleep when I went to the screening when I worked at the theater, which is the Miami Vice one.
Oh,
which
sure.
Like, how about like just like a 25 minute, like on just one continuous shot kind of scene at the end where, yeah, but I was starting to like get tired.
Yes.
I know. It feels like it's a really long scene because you're already exhausted.
It's a cool scene.
Yeah.
And I was
it's at the end of a marathon already. It's like you have another lap to go.
It's so weird because the movie, like, in some ways it goes completely overboard with particularly in the shootout after the big heist. That shootout goes on for so long.
I love it so much.
It's crazy. It's like, they're just gunfire, go! Do-do-do-do-do-do, cut out to the other guy. Boom, boom, cut back. Do-do-do-do-do, go! Do-do-do-do-do-boom. I'm just like, okay, we get it. They're shooting. Like, you don't even know who's shooting at who at any one point. It just keeps cutting to characters shooting off screen. And we don't, like, see line of... Sometimes you see, like, somebody shoot and somebody get fall down. But, like, we never see, like, line of sights and then they get surrounded. So, like...
When you're shooting one direction, then whip a 180 and shoot the other direction. 180
back.
If there's someone behind you, you're dead.
So like it goes super overboard, and then
Val Kilmer looks cool doing it though.
Very cool.
And then other times it takes things so slow and takes so long to get it anywhere. Like in this end scene where they're like running through the fields and it's just like no music, or was there music? Was it just kind of like?
I can't remember.
They're like one shot. Okay, we're running over here.
But the lights are cool. The planes are flying overhead. It's kind of masterful.
It was a vibe.
I liked it,
It was a vibe.
The movie has vibes for days. I can't take that away.
That's what I'm saying. This movie is somewhere between an 8 and a 10. Like, it's for some people it's a 10. Yeah. For other people it's a 5.5 or 6.5.
I feel like I see so much potential here, and it honestly felt sort of like one of these Netflix movies where they just give the creator free rein to do whatever they want, and there's not nearly enough like trimming and editing and focusing of the vision. It's just kind of like bloated.
This is sort of like his second go at making this movie, because he made a TV movie that has a lot of the same elements. I've never seen it, but like there's the same, you know, tow truck smashing into an armored bank, like a lot of the same set pieces.
What do you think defines you as a creator? I just really like seeing tow trucks. I like really like seeing semi trucks smashing into stuff.
Pretty fucking cool.
It's a cool thing.
I have some questions, some nitpicks, and some hit picks. Are we there yet?
Are we?
Well, they're both playing.
Nitpicks.
Okay. Interesting. Let's do it, David.
Nitpicky question. What does De Niro hear when he's being watched at the metal place and the guy like sits down in the truck? He's inside. He's inside
the
building.
No, he's not. He's in that corner, remember? He's outside the building hiding the shadows of that corner.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I must have like not processed.
That's a great shot when they make the noise and then he's like looking at
the camera.
The night vision camera.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And his like face is all messed up.
That's a great shot for that, because the audience is wondering, did he hear it?
Yeah. He looks like a wolf and or a predator or something, and he's spotted
because
you.
Because it obscures his face, we can't tell if he's reacting to it.
I love how quickly they're willing to drop it. Like, he's like He goes up to Val Kilmer. He's like, we're walking. And he's like, no, I'm right there. I'm right there. We're walking. And then he's like, okay. And drops it and goes. And I'm like, that's cool. That's
nice. Cool.
We walk. Yeah, that's cool.
He's willing to walk away in 30 seconds.
Hit pick. Neil's house, where like the extreme ocean view, really adds to like his, like the empty, meaningless life.
He's got like almost no furniture.
Minimalism,
or
loneliness. Yeah.
Minimalism. I mean, yeah. I respect the man.
huge hit pick. The character of Natalie Portman and her mom look like they could be mom and daughter. I was like, wow, they look the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they look sort of related, sure.
They're good. Natalie Portman, she's a great actress. I totally dug or like believed her kind of emotional instability.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it all made sense. I think I was just like, why are we writing this complicated of a situation to be Vincent Hanna's home life? But I guess it's like, I don't know. It was just like, I think part of me was annoyed at why things were so unique. Like, so such a, like, this is such a specific social arrangement. Like, why do we go with this?
I like that kind of stuff, though, because if they don't do that, then you're not really exploring anything interesting. You're just like, oh, yeah, they're doing the bare minimum to give him a family life.
Well, no, I'm not saying that you need to give him, like, a boring-ass normal family life. I just mean that, like, it was just, like, a lot to take in. It's like, okay, so this is his third marriage. Mm-hmm. It's her second marriage. She's still kind of in a relation, like she's the ex-husband is in her life. They're living in his house. The stepdaughter is there. Stepdaughter's depressed.
And she sometimes
mother's taking Prozac and stuff.
He refers to himself as dad, but she calls him Vincent.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on.
I think I was just kind of like, what is this arrangement?
And it's like one of the first scenes of the movie, like when you first are introduced to Vincent, you actually spend more time with Natalie Portman's character arguing with the mom than you do with Vincent. Nope. And I was like, is she going to get kidnapped in the next 10 minutes or what? Like, why are we putting so much into this?
I like that kind of stuff, though. Like, even how she's having a breakdown specifically about finding the clips or whatever she wants to put in here. It's like, I have the red ones. I want the blue ones. I want the blue ones. Because that feels very, like, real.
100%. 100%.
That was good characterization, and it, like, told us information about the dad.
Yeah, and so I like all those specific things that take time to define. Because there's just a new dimension to all of it because you understand some of the dynamics of it.
So the movie spends time on that stuff, but it doesn't just like spend runtime willy-nilly on all sorts of crap. Here's a hit pick of being very efficient, which is Van Zandt. Van Zandt ultimately just gets shot on his couch, but he is meant to be a threat. He is meant to be some pressure on these protagonists, right? And we don't have a lot of time to spend to characterize Van Zandt. So what do we get? When they call him, when he's about to like put him on hold or something like that, you hear a woman speaking Spanish, just blah, 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 Spanish, like full on. And she's talking to Van Zandt. She's right beside him. And so it's like, oh, this guy's bilingual, like the high degree bilingual. You must be intelligent then. And so it's just like, what is the shortest, like quickest way that we can indicate that Van Zandt is like a serious person?
Yeah. That's interesting.
That was dope.
I guess so.
nitpick. When Al Pacino's tailing De Niro on the highway, the speed ramps annoyed me. In a movie that is restrained, there's like they're accelerating the footage to make it look like he's going faster.
Oh, I didn't know.
Very unnecessary.
There was some like really chaotic cinematography there. At one point, when he breaks in the door to when Neil breaks down the door to take down Waingro, it switches to like a fisheye like first person perspective
super
cut
weird.
For like 1 second. It was so quick.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, okay, we're doing that.
If I was assigned a film school essay on it, I would be like, you know, it signifies his broken mental state. He's aggressive. He's seeing red, you know? It's tunnel vision. So you can get, this is a movie, for me, it's on the line of, am I giving it credit and trying to analyze it on a really deep level, or is it just a good heist movie with some dimensionality?
Does it deserve the benefit of the doubt?
I guess maybe that's part of the reason why I rated it low, because it shoots for the stars. It shoots
all the way.
Super high.
But it has restraint.
And I think it just doesn't really get there.
It has restraint, though. Like this is another hit pick of mine. That opening heist is so intense, but they cap the intensity because they want to go higher later. Like, you've got these shots where, you know, like, they got their stopwatch going. They're waiting for the cops to show up. They just have these guys at gunpoint. There's almost no music. It's just like...
Yeah.
And there's these big panning Michael Bay style shots. But, like, it's a lot and a little at the same time. And you just know, like, it's very intense, but they've left headroom to be more intense on the bank heist later.
For sure. No, the two heist scenes are amazing. And the and the break in at the metal plant or whatever.
Yeah. And the soundtrack in general.
All of those scenes are extremely well done. It's just all the stuff in between. Well,
I love this like synth wave chill kind of soundtrack. Well, it's kind of Blade Runner-y.
I take it back. The shootout after the bike heist is way too long.
No, I love it.
It becomes comedic for me because I'm like, this is just.
I don't know. There's something
about
it.
How many clips do we have?
There's something about it where it's just like, it just.
Well, it's that predator prey thing again with Pacino's character.
Yeah, I think this movie really succeeds. Other than like the few things we mentioned in terms of like morality having shifted, I think it aged exceptionally well in terms of aesthetic and style.
100%.
Mm. Like the music, there's a one moment where I was like, oh, that's kind of like dated sound, but the sound, it's very modern.
Oh,
it's
very, I think I noted that as well. Especially like I complained about the end, the shootout and the chase taking too long. But the end, when Neil gets shot, it's just super powerful at that. The music kind of swells up. It's really emotional. I was actually surprised at how annoyed I was at the movie and like specifically that chase leading up to it. And then suddenly having that annoyance kind of transfer into like, damn, I'm touched.
Yeah.
It was a really powerful ending.
Yep.
I loved it.
I feel like Michael Mann doesn't get enough credit. People don't talk about him enough. He's lots of great movies. Collateral.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Mm. That's a good movie. I feel like it's underrated because, you know, it's kind of crazy. And it's Tom Cruise too. People sleep on Tom Cruise's actual acting. He's always like, you know, the action star, but he's pretty decent when he tries.
He's a good actor, yeah. And Jamie Foxx is great too.
Yeah.
Oh, another movie, what does he have? The Criminals. The one with Johnny Depp and Christian Bale. Freaking, damn it, the John Dillinger one.
I'm not sure. But,
Johnny D.
Oh, the last of the, no, that's producer. Let me see. Director stuff. To me, Michael Mann is Collateral and Heat, but I don't really. My advice.
Public Enemies.
Oh yeah, those Public good movies. Those pretty decent.
Sort of a. Let's get back to a nitpick for me. Is it a nitpick? I don't know. The evening at the restaurant when they're having like the crew dinner, but it feels like you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's the scene where they're just showing. Look how everyone has a family except you.
Yeah, but I just thought that was funny because I'm like, okay, so this is a thief crew. Some of them have families and kids. Is it implied that the wives know what they are?
Because
does Charlene know? Charlene knows.
Because she says $8,000 for what you do is not enough. She
right.
said in one of their first.
But then the other guy also has a wife and kids, and I'm used to seeing this sort of thing in like a mafia movie, and I feel like there's some scenes in this movie where it seems like it's sort of confused about what its identity is or what the criminals don't know what their identity is. Neil is like trying to be sort of like this mafioso boss guy where he's like, he's a professional thief, but then he's also going around to people being like, you better give him another chance because this is what the proper thing to do in our situation, in our social group.
He just cares about his friend.
Well, he cares about his friend, but it's like, he's a professional thief with like such a strong sense of morality, and he's like trying to keep his friends in line. Like, usually these like thief crews are depicted as being like, all right, we're cutthroat. If you can't keep up, then you get cut loose.
But I think this one, he's like a compelling protagonist.
He's like trying.
Maybe he's being selfish.
He's like a YouTuber building a company, and he's got like a little like group of people that is his underlings. But they're like,
maybe he's being selfish because he doesn't want. He knows that Chris says that his like sun rises and sets with Charlene, right? So maybe he thinks that he won't be able to. De Niro's crew won't be able to do the big heist if Charlene leaves, because Chris will be so upset, and then he'll lose a team member and he won't be able to get what he wants.
I can see that reading.
He could be selfish.
I don't know. I mean, I think that he knows deep down that he wants to not do this. I mean, that he shouldn't do this. We talked about this.
De Niro's been in his 40s his entire life, eh? I was like, how is this from 95 and he's still older than me?
Yeah.
Damn.
And The Irishman came out and he looked 28 in that.
That's crazy. He doesn't look as good as in Godfather 2, though. He's so hot in Godfather 2.
You guys got anything else? I'm done here.
Sort of a hit pick when Drucker is like laying out Charlene's options, where he's like,
oh yeah.
I loved that scene because I'm not sure whether the movie meant to do this, but I was just making me think about how our country is, or America, whatever, is so fucked that if both of Dominic's parents go to jail, he's like, you know that if you both of you go to jail, then this kid is fucked for life because of our country. Like, it's like we don't have enough of a safety net that if you both, it's like that's the leverage that he has to use.
Yeah. Well, that would apply here too, but
No, I'm not saying America only. I'm saying like,
well, what happens is like, do you have an auntie or a grandparent or a family member or a friend? And if not, then you'll go into the system. And if you're in the system, you're disadvantaged.
Yeah, that I think it was just funny everywhere. To have, and this happens all the time, but like it was just a funny scene where a member of the government, a government official is...
He's extorting her though.
Is, you know, telling her how fucked up the government is. Other nitpick for me is when Vincent comes home and Ralph is there.
Oh, that guy was awesome. They picked that kind of pathetic looking dude.
Yeah, he was
dude.
Just like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know, blah, blah, blah. And he's just being used by Justine to get the attention of Vincent. And then Vincent is like, okay, look, hey, you sit down. You know, I'm not angry at you. But then he still is angry. And it's like, you don't get to watch my television.
Xander Berkeley is his name.
And Justine says, see, you don't let me in, and now I have to demean myself with Ralph just to get closer with you.
That is like, pretty good.
That was one of my hit picks for sure.
I would love to know what other movies that guy's in, but this IMDb thing is dumb.
Okay, I got two more hit picks. One is Edie's face watching Neil back away from the car as Hannah is coming up.
Oh, yeah.
And Neil is like, oh, I can't get caught. And he's like backing away, and Edie is looking at him. Like, oh no. And I think the movie's trying to play it as like a sad parting lovers moment where it's like, oh no, we love each other, but we have to part ways. Oh, it's so sad. But I kept looking at Edie's face and I just saw her being like, bro, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, you tackled me to the ground and held me hostage. And then I changed my mind and agreed to go with you. And now you're fucking ditching.
I also didn't really get why he just like didn't immediately get in the car and drive away. I don't know. Running seemed like,
well,
because
I think
option.
He like he didn't. It, I don't know. The movie sold it to me that he didn't have time to get in there and get out of there. I mean, everything was crowded and like there wasn't really a.
You're
route.
Right. It's not easy to drive out.
Yeah.
I guess that's the point. He created that chaos, but now the chaos is trapping him.
Yo, okay, wait. Hold on though. That Xander Berkeley guy. He's in Terminator 2. And then remember he plays the stepdad, John Connor's foster parent.
I was wondering where I
You're not my dad. No, she's not my mom, Todd. That's fucking awesome. So I knew he looked familiar.
Okay, wait. Did you guys think Edie was a cop when we first met her?
No.
No.
You didn't?
No.
I could see it, though, because well, like, she sits down right beside him.
Neil is suspicious of her being a cop.
Yeah. Which is why I was like, because he's just minding his business there, and then she's like asking him all these questions, and he's like, why are you asking so many questions? And she has a weird accent. I felt like the accent was put on a little bit. They're in LA and she's like talking like this. I'm just from the South.
Agent Starling is here.
Yeah, right. Anyways, I guess she didn't turn out being a cop, so that's nice.
That is nice.
Jodie Foster, guys, that's a Silence of the Lambs reference. Watch it.
Yeah, and then watch other movies.
That's a great episode
we did. That's a really good episode. It's a great movie.
Another nitpick, really. Van Zandt on the phone with Neil. And he's like, what are you doing? And Neil's like, what am I doing? I'm talking to an empty telephone. Because there's a dead man on the other end of this fucking line. I'm like, ladies and gentlemen, now that is a badass. It's just like, come on. Because there's a dead man. I don't know. It seemed like super, super cheesy.
He should have just ended it there. I'm talking to an empty telephone. Click.
That would have been good.
That would have been better. The writing in this movie is a bit weird. There's a couple scenes that are really like kind of too poetic.
Right.
Like Vincent's wife, when she's like, you're a predator. You survey the terrain and pick your prey.
Yeah.
And it's like really, it's almost like slam poetry.
I can really see the writer in that moment. I'm just like, yeah, and this is what maybe a woman would think of me if I was.
I don't know what what her job is in this movie, like if she's a literary critic or something, but I just think she is because of the way she talks.
Yeah.
I like that headcanon. That's fun.
Last hit pick. This is a hit pick. I thought Vincent was going to, when he opened the door of his car and the people were sitting on the road, I thought he was going to give the TV to them.
Yeah, and he just kicks it
and destroys it.
And they look at each other. One guy's laughing.
Yeah. I'm like, damn, dude, that was a perfectly good TV.
He's pissed.
It'd be valuable today.
All right. I'm going to hit this button here.
Hit it.
For the second time. So, fan service. There's a comment on our Train to Busan or Train to Bussy episode. Before the show, I was talking about, I was excited for days that I was going to refer to the movie as just Bussy. But I never did in the episode. It sucks.
You got your chance.
There it is.
Here it is.
Anyways, there's a comment on there about, we were talking about, why does he get her a Wii in like 2016 when the Wii U was out. And this comment says, Korea has such a small market in the console space that Nintendo decided to skip the Nintendo Wii U. So Nintendo Wii was technically the only Nintendo console selling in Korea until the Switch came out.
Okay. Interesting.
And I didn't grab your username, so let me research that now while you guys talk.
Interesting.
There's some comments about me like transitioning to the army. I don't know what that's about. One guy's like, Riley really has lost his damn mind. I'm so sorry for your loss. But I don't, was I crazy last episode? I thought what did I give it? I gave it like a 7 or something, right?
Something reasonable, I thought.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about.
They agree with me. It's Dirtiest Harry was the comment for the user.
Jeez Louise.
Harry!
That's funny.
That's Home Alone. All right. Guys, got anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Are you watching anything? Should I hit the now playing button? No?
Sure.
Wow, hit the button.
People like our song. It's me. I'm playing something. I'm playing through. So God of War Ragnarok comes out next week. So I'm playing through the entire franchise. And the old games in my head.
You've played this franchise.
All the way through. I love it.
Many times.
God of War. Though I still haven't played God of War Ascension. I probably will skip that. That's like kind of the side story.
Mm.
Came after God of War 3. Man, they make some fucking games.
Do they?
Yeah.
Good ones.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you can see the storytelling develop as they went. So as it started, it's just, you know, this really pissed off dude out for revenge, and there's not really much dimensionality. In the second game, they try and flesh him out a little bit. But by the third game, they really fuck it up by trying to make him a rounded character because he's still filled with all this rage.
Right.
And he's irredeemable, and he, like, kills people just for utility. But then he also... they try to give him this humanity, this by having a young girl that has to sacrifice herself so that he can get what he wants. But like at the end, he can't, spoilers for God of War 3. He can't do it. Like, you know, like, oh no, like I can't do it. I can't ask you that. We'll find another way. But that's like, he had in scenes prior, he had also killed a woman, an innocent woman, just so he could like open a door.
Mm.
But they keep cutting between this, like, you know, struggle and this thing, and I thought it was really interesting, and then it made me really appreciate the 2018 God of War.
Yeah.
So much.
See, I never played any of the God of War games, like the old ones.
Yeah.
Primarily because I never had a PlayStation console.
Fair enough.
But
yeah, the knockoff.
But I never felt an
Deity of Skirmish.
Huh?
No, never mind.
Was that
so stupid? Okay. So stupid.
That was bad.
Yeah, I thought you were. Yeah.
But I also never felt like the FOMO that I felt with like other Sony franchises because these games looked just kind of like angry bad guys. I'm so angry.
It's had those sequences where it's like a bunch of action happening on the screen. And all you have to do is like hit the right button.
Yeah. So
what are those called again?
Quick time events.
Yeah, those looked so easy and stupid.
So they had them and they were awesome for the time. There's still some pretty sweet moments of like, you know, flying through the air. Like in God of War 3, there's a moment where you're on Gaia's fist and she's punching Poseidon, and like it's a slow motion of you and like you're like on her fist and you jump off and then you hit the quick time event and then you like launch through Poseidon. Like there's some pretty cool badass,
it's a cool
moments.
Cinematic element. It's a way for you to feel involved in a cinematic.
Yeah,
basically.
And they got,
but they're never challenging, are they?
No.
In any game, is it ever like, ah, damn, wrong button, it's too fast.
You actually didn't press it fast enough.
I know the controller so well. Like, I knew it so well back when I gamed
so
like that.
With God of War, as the difficulty goes up, the window to hit the button goes down. And so if I'm not like fully paying attention, I have missed it. But it's not, the point isn't to be challenging, it's to make you feel like a badass.
If you miss it, how annoying is it? You gotta watch the whole damn sequence.
But
again.
If you think of it as being like, why isn't this a gameplay sequence, then it could be annoying. But if you think of it as just, well, I'm watching a cutscene and I have to press a button every once in a while, then it's fine.
I like to skip cutscenes.
But I think that's like the.
What?
I mean, I'm just playing.
In a story game?
I'm playing a non cutscene advocate here. Devil's advocate.
But I think
a
well-designed quick time event doesn't feel so separate from gameplay. It feels like it's like, you know, it's a specific gameplay thing. It's not just like a video that's playing
and this
it cuts
Uncharted
out.
would be the best. Uncharted.
Uncharted, sorry, sort of. Uncharted was way more storytelling before God of War was, because Uncharted 1 came out before God of War 3, which is when they tried to transition out into more storytelling, but they couldn't. Like Kratos they had back then was too like single-minded.
Yeah.
It didn't work. It was bad. But the new Kratos, which is like a man filled with regret from what he's done, is fucking fantastic. And they've done such a good job making it connected, but its own thing.
I finished the 2018 God of War.
Oh, yeah.
earlier this year, yeah. I guess, after trying to play it a couple years ago, and it was because it was on PlayStation Now, and then they took it off, so I couldn't actually even play it on PC. But then they added it, then it actually came out on Steam, so I played it
PlayStation later.
It was it was so good. Fantastic. I loved it. And like, yeah, and having not played the game,
you're playing that crap at your lunch break here.
I know.
I remember that.
That's what I do.
It's a good thing to do in your
lunch
break.
In 30-minute chunks. But yeah, and having not played the previous games, and just knowing that it's about Angry Guy, and now playing this game and having it deliver so well, unlike the idea of this guy, like, okay, those shitty games, he's like, he regrets how shitty the games were.
Yeah.
And he's trying to learn how to be a father, and like, it's okay now to have a main character who's one of his main character traits is rage, because now he's trying to restrain the rage,
yeah.
And there's good comparison with like the character of his wife and his son and other characters who are like, what happened to you, dude?
Yeah.
It's so good.
I'm so excited. And it's interesting, having gone back, is the jump from like God of War 2, I think, is the peak of the previous ones. And it's, you know, it's very similar to 1, but they just like tightened it so much. And I used to be a little bit sad that Ragnarok was like, you know, God of War 2018 2. Like, it's not like a whole new thing.
Right.
But I'm actually more excited now that it's just, they have all these elements, all these pieces that they can just refine and get so tight. And I'm anticipating Ragnarok is going to be like God of War 2, but, you know, God of War 2.
Yeah.
And I can't believe how excited I am for this.
They also did a really good job.
Next Tuesday.
Did you pre-order it?
I did, because I'm doing a no purchase November thing. So I'm trying to not buy any unnecessary expenditures this month.
Nice.
I'm trying to do a full month of like no games, no nothing.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's my regular life, not spending money on anything. Except eating out. DoorDash is bad.
Ooh,
I know.
That counts.
It does. I know it counts. Yeah, I know.
That's on my...
What I was going to say is that the first God of War also did a really good job of like setting up continuing story.
Well, I remember as the game
spoilers, but there's some interesting things that are revealed.
I'm just interested in this no spend November thing, though. So... Can you, like, you're getting groceries, right?
Yeah, so and food then, and bills is fine.
But then you're like, let's get a cake.
A cake?
Like,
I'm just going to go buy a cake.
Let's get some ice cream.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Like fine. An extra, like an extra.
So I think I'm going to allow myself, you know, stuff I want at the grocery store, but it's like, I'm not going to go and like.
What if you just end up splurging at the grocery? You're like, I'm getting candied salmon.
I'm at Walmart. I'll buy a video game. It's just like groceries. I don't know. It's not like a super well thought out thing. I just want to like, you know, break the cycle of using retail therapy. I think that's like a common thing these days. It's like, well, I work hard. I deserve my luxuries. Mm. And so you use your luxuries to kind of placate yourself. And you kind of get caught in the cycle of like, I'm not happy. So I'll buy things to make me happy, but it doesn't actually fill anything. And you're kind of stuck.
Right.
I want to like, you know, put brakes on that. Take some time, think about myself, and then, you know, get some more savings. I want to buy a house one day.
That's good.
By spending $100, a couple $100 a month on stupid stuff, that could be going into savings.
Good on you, David. Treats are essential. End of the day, treats are one of the essentials.
Treats. Then they wouldn't be called treats.
Lauren and I, like, we just have like a stock of Maynard's sour watermelons in the cabinet.
Sure. Oh, you're a sour couple.
Yeah.
Let me guess. She likes them.
She and likes
you,
them.
You think they're okay?
I like them. I like Maltesers. I also eat. I eat everything, so I'll eat some of those. I'll eat some Maltesers. Yeah. I'll eat some Reese's Pieces.
Yeah,
Reese's Pieces.
We have to be stocked up.
Yeah, what is a little boy like? Your child?
He doesn't eat candy. He's like 2.5. We just had a Halloween, and he was like handing out Halloween candy at the door.
Didn't even know what it was.
He doesn't know what it is. I'm like, nice.
That's perfect. I'm envious. My kids know. Because my wife just gets so much pleasure in being like, oh, let him lick the ice cream cone. I'm like,
he has ice cream, and like he will recognize, because like Lauren has like these Hershey's bars and stuff, and like he's had some of that. So when he sees her Hershey's bars, he's like, but he doesn't know what the little candies.
Yeah, I went trick or treating with my kids last night, and I opened up a little Snickers and I was eating it, and Bobby was doing the more sign language thing, because he doesn't talk very much either.
Right.
I'm like, you little son of a bitch. Fine.
Yeah.
I have to regurgitate it for him, you know?
Well.
He can't bite that.
What'd you guys go for?
Mine now playing is, I finished Disco Elysium.
Oh,
the
nice.
The video game.
How'd you like it?
Extremely, a lot. It's very good.
A lot.
You're related?
I feel like it's one of the only video games that I've played that is like so satisfying intellectually, in terms of like, it's all about like politics and ideology and history and all these like socioeconomic things. It's super great. But I tried to go from that to one of the dumbest games to ever exist.
Overwatch 2.
Anthem.
Oh, why?
I'm playing Anthem.
Why? I thought they shut down the servers.
So when they announced Anthem, the world and the lore and the soundtrack came out and the music was so good. I was just like listening to the trailer music like over and over because it was so cool. It involves this planet, and there's this like force called the Anthem of Creation, and people are trying to harness it and control it. And so there's like deep, crazy, magical, spiritual things going on. And then you're Iron Man, basically, and you can fly around and upgrade your armor, and it's sick.
Wait, let's pause there. What's the deal with Tom Cruise Iron Man?
I think it says the rumors, aren't they?
I thought that a trailer came out. Or was that fan-made?
No, it's a
fan-made
trailer.
What
are you talking about?
It's a fan-made trailer.
I saw something that was about like Tom Cruise being Iron Man.
No, that would have been a bigger deal than Henry Cavill exiting The Witcher.
This is your now playing?
I saw
a trailer for...
No, I didn't see
fan-made trailer.
Do you guys have thoughts on Henry Cavill leaving The Witcher? Have you guys watched The Witcher?
I didn't watch The Witcher, but from the statements I saw, it seemed like it wasn't like he got fired or like any kind of controversial thing. He was just like, yeah, I'm going to do other things in my career. I'm passing the torch. I enjoyed my time.
As far as Superman again.
Yeah, the theories are... Yeah.
DCEU.
DCEU. I heard James Bond, which I don't think... I like Henry Cavill a lot, but I don't think he's the right fit for James Bond.
No, too big and too American.
The big thing...
He's American, right?
No, he's British.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Fuck, I can't
imagine that. You would assume, right? He seems so American.
Superman, goddammit.
But he... And I might be wrong.
They're all British.
But he... The current narrative that's being created in the fandom is that he was really upset because the Netflix show and the writers apparently have been openly, like, have disdain for the books and the games. Like, they don't like it. They want to make their own thing, whereas he's read every single book. He wanted to do 7 seasons, but he wanted it to be accurate, and so he's fought them. Like, there's the story that there was a scene he hated when Roach died. Sorry, spoilers for The Witcher. I guess Barrett...
No! Roach is like Chewie, right?
Yes. Yes. It's his chocolate bar. His famous chocolate bar.
What? Chewbacca?
No, Chewie. Charleston Chew.
Okay.
Chewbacca Chew.
Continue.
But he hated how the writers handled it. It was supposed to be like kind of offhand a joke and then move on. And he's like, no, that's not what we're going to do. And he was like, I don't like this. And I'm like, well, fine, write it yourself. And he went to the books. He found a monologue and he made it happen.
Really?
And he made it accurate to what Geralt would have done in the books. And fans love that scene. And so the direction he was taking the show, according to fans and like what the fans have now created as the narrative in their heads, is like the real Witcher, and Netflix wants to do like this cheap, like shitty
Switcher.
Yeah, the Switcher, sure.
Bitcher? What else can we call it?
I mean, all this is, you know, like story, like seventh hand stories. So I'm very curious to have this story develop, but I think that the person they replaced him with is Hemsworth.
Oh, yeah, Liam Hemsworth.
Yeah.
It's another Thor brother. Yeah.
Is a terrible choice.
Oh, yeah?
Henry Cavill is the fucking most masculine looking person.
Wait, is this the dude that was in that Barbarian movie we watched?
No.
I actually thought
he would be okay. That's a Skarsgård.
Yeah, that's right.
Liam Hemsworth is the original love interest in The Hunger Games.
but
what was that guy? PETA?
No, PETA is the
I mean, Liam's I don't know. Look at these guys. They're like the same. They're very similar builds.
He looks jacked, that's for sure.
No, but his face, it doesn't have the squareness that Henry Cavill has. And I also think that Henry Cavill occupied that role with passion and fervor that only a nerd could.
Mm.
And I think that even if Liam's, it's one of those things, there's a no win for Liam. Even if he did as good of a job, it won't be as good of a job in the eyes of the fandom.
Yeah, I doubt. Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for Liam because he's probably going into this not fully understanding.
No. He just was like, oh, nice, a $10 million Netflix contract. Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, he's not getting a ton of like high profile work right now. So I feel like getting offered this job, it's like you'd be kind of dumb not to take it. For and sure. It's like, what? I'm not a Witcher fan, but like I imagine that I wouldn't be mad at Liam Hemsworth. Like, no. I don't think that he would lose out in this situation.
Well, it's one of those things where in an ideal world, you kill off Geralt and you bring in this new Witcher and you
say,
I don't think you can just like without ceremony change.
He'll
who
be
plays
he'll be gender
it.
Swapped Ciri. Kiri. What's her name?
Ciri.
no, she's already in the show, right?
Yeah, she's already in the show. But I don't know. It's tough. It's tough playing those metagames and like, I am so fascinated to see is it for Superman? Is it for a specific thing? Like what happened? And I want to know Did he leave? Did they fire him? Was it a mutual thing? Like, we're just not on the same page? Because he originally said he wants to do 7 seasons, and he was on board for 7 seasons of the show.
Well.
And then it's, here's the last thing. The third season isn't even out, and they've announced that he's, in season 4, they're going to have a new Witcher. Is that normal? Like, I feel like that's weird to pre-season, that's not even, like, done, it's not even close to being out, to announce that, like, the season after they're making a change. Because now, like, no one wants to watch this season.
I feel like Netflix
has... It's marinating still. You can't season it while it's marinating.
I feel like Netflix has done this for some of their, like, high-profile series. Like, Stranger Things, I think you knew when, like, season 3 came out that there were, like, 2 more seasons or something, okay. But...
Yeah, maybe they're, like, ripping off the Band-Aid.
Gale Hawthorne. That's who he played in 100 Big Games.
Sure.
My big question is whether the next Superman... thing, whether the next
is also going to be a Hemsworth
is also going to be shit again. Like,
well,
can we have like Superman from the comics already? Well, like, can we? I'm tired of these like
postmodern Superman.
Dark, gritty, nihilistic reboots of yes. DC superheroes. Can we just get like the regular ones?
Well, we got what's his face? Gunn. James Gunn is now in charge of all the animated DC movies.
Just the animated ones?
I don't think in the TV shows maybe, but it seems like they're bringing in someone like him, which I think is a much better vision than Zack Snyder. Why did they fucking bet on Zack Snyder?
Because 300 ruled, man. And then he made, I guess, Watchmen. They must have liked the look of Watchmen. And Watchmen rules.
Watchmen is good.
We should cover that movie.
Oh, sure. So James Gunn is going to be heading up DC Studios alongside Peter Safran. So I guess they're both...
That's the most expensive size.
Kind of like taking the role of... what's his
Kevin
name? Kevin Feige in MCU. And apparently they are looking to make a more joyful Superman. So
good.
That's good.
Good. We don't need a postmodern take on Superman. Superman succeeded because he was different than the other heroes.
Right.
And trying to make him as dark and gritty as the other ones doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think
guys,
it was such
out
a,
here.
Yeah, it was such a mistake to to make the mainstream Superman that like dark and gritty one.
Yeah.
You can do dark and gritty Superman. You can do like Elseworlds tales, but don't make it the main one.
And Henry Cavill was not the problem. It was the writing.
Okay, that's all. That's all.
It. We did it.
Thanks for watching, guys.
Next week.
Next week, again, is Kung Pao, Enter the Fist, and then he killed the dog. Oh,
the
my God.
This episode.
I love all the voices. God.
It's good for both of us.
Yeah, that's fucking awesome. And what about Betty's voice? Can you do that one?
I forget who that is.
Bambi.
Oh, no. Oh.
He's the bad guy.
I don't remember.
What do you get when you cross an owl with that bungee cord? My ass.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Fuck, this is going to be an awesome episode.
I'm so excited.
Anyways, you can tweet at us at TJMPod. You can email us hello@theyrejustmovies.com. And you should email us your troubles with your partner, with your family,
mental health
struggles.
Ask us how to solve everything in your life, and we will.
We're going
to
tell you.
We're going to be your Dan
Guaranteed.
Savage for the day.
What?
We'll be your Dan Savage for the day.
That's right. And we'll have a trust me bro warranty on the advice we give you.
Yeah, it's not financial advice. But dude,
it could be.
I'll give financial advice. Bye.
See you later. Love you.